This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. This episode today is sponsored by BDoc's Timeline 3D, which is now in the App Store and available for download. I've just recently downloaded it, and it's turned out to be pretty excellent. I'm really, really pleased with the way that's turned out in iOS. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's been a great week. How about you?
It's been a busy week so far. We had our monthly iPad visit today, which was interesting. My school has obviously been quite a popular place for people to come and visit and see how iPads are used in practice. And we've had to finally sort of cut that down to a once a month visit day that we run because it had started to get to the point where we were having two or three a week and that wasn't sustainable. So we now have one a month. You can sign up for tickets on our website if anybody wants to come. It's free for teachers, but today was that day. So we were having a interesting chat, shall we say, with teachers from other schools. And usually these things devolve, and today was no exception, into hearing some sort of networking horror stories, which I've just been having a bit of fun on Twitter, soliciting other network horror stories from people using the hashtag NetHorror if you want to join in or search on what we've been talking about there.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I was watching that. It's almost one of those things, if you're an IT person, you get on there and see one of your teachers commenting, then you maybe have some work to do. I was actually supposed to sit in on an iTunes U webinar today, but the website never would launch. And then I got about an email about 15 minutes in that they were having technical difficulties and to check it again in 10 minutes, but it would be posted online in December. And truth be told, I would just prefer webinars to be that way anyways. Maybe just go ahead and pre-record it, put it in the iTunes store, let me download it, sync it to my iPad, and then maybe give me an email address for follow-up if I have any questions. Just because it usually, for example, one of our vendors is on a different time zone than me, and so they'll do a lot of, like on my time, 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock webinars. But on Central Time, it's 10 o'clock to noon. And so, like, it ends up cutting into my lunch, when I typically take a lunch break. And so I just would assume them to be downloadable and let me watch them later. Because what I do a lot with webinars, too, is I'm very much an auditory learner. And so I will actually check the audio aloud of a lot of webinars and then just actually sync it and listen to it a few times. Mm. Because I found that I learn better that way if I can listen to it over and over again.
So, yeah, I'm actually lined up to do one of these webinars for Apple at the end of the month. We'll put a link in show notes for people who might want to sign up for that one. That's going to be on the 26th of November. And that's one of, I think, two that are being done by the European team around about one-to-one deployments. So I know the US team have been doing some around iTunes U in particular. The one I'm planning to do is a little bit more general. It's just really about the Cedar story. But what's going to happen with that, and I think this is the reason why they do at least the webinar format first and then archive it for later viewing, is that as we do the presentation, live questions are going to come in. So the people who sign up for it will be able to post questions live. And then once the presentation is done, we'll try and answer those questions after the fact. So come along with your hard questions and I'll do my best to answer them.
I guess before we get into the topic today, I got an email from a listener I wanted to run through, and he sent me two emails basically answering his question in the second one, but I thought it was still worthwhile. He says, enjoy your podcast. Find it very useful. We have 400 iPads distributed to our students now. I've talked with this listener offline beforehand, and they're using them in big ways. One quick question. Our senior English teacher had students do essays, which they then share with her via Google Drive. She made corrections via the iPad keyboard, and the changes instantly showed up on the kids' versions. She liked that, but would like to be able to edit them in something like Notability or GoodNotes, where she can use a red pen to mark up. We know we can do that via emailing things back and forth, but is there an app or procedure to do that without the bother of emailing copies of the essays back and forth? In other words, something as seamless as Google Drive, where the changes occur instantly without having to email or upload. He then responded, I've since discovered a pretty good workable solution, and a free one at that. It's a website and an app called Shobi. It's Shobie.com, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Let the teacher create assignments currently right now only via a browser, a desktop, or as far on the iPad. But then the students can use Pages, Keynote, and other apps to place their work into the assignment folder. Not sure how that works. It may be over WebDAV. I'm not 100% sure. Teachers can then, on their iPads, open the student work and send it to Notability, and then mark it up, and then send it back into the Shobi app, and the corrections will be there. So then students can see the grading and corrections that the teacher did, just like they did on their paper. Says, you know, basically we'd love to see this in Google Drive. And you know, I think this really comes back to the crux of where there is some confusion for teachers, especially is there isn't a one size fits all app. You know, we were dealing with a situation with some of our staff meetings. Some people wanted to use Evernote to take staff meeting notes, but then kind of work on the, everybody wanted to work on the same notes. And I kind of threw up a red flag. I said, look, that's not what Evernote collaboration was meant for. If you're wanting to do real-time editing, you need to be using Google Docs. If you're wanting to just be able to kind of throw things in there for archiving, you edit something and somebody later can add to it, that's fine. But if you're all trying to work on the same thing at the same time, that's just not going to work. And so I think what we're really needing here is, it sounds like a full-featured Google Drive iPad app. And I, as I mentioned in previous shows, it does appear that Google may be working towards that with the purchase of QuickOffice, but it seems like we're trying to, you know, use this app for this and use this app for that and then email it back and forth. We're really needing a kind of like a seamless solution that can do grading. It can do uploading of work and things like that. So, but Shobi, I'm going to look into it and just see how it is.
Yep. All that whole world is super immature right now. One tip for doing that in Evernote is to have everybody work on a separate note in the same notebook and then merge them at the end. Because that way you don't end up with conflicts. And that's complicated to organize, and you can only typically organize that when you're face to face with all the people who are editing. But you know, you can say, well, you edit this note and you edit that note, and then I'll edit this note, and then at the end we'll merge all of the notes together.
I was kind of laughing about it seemed like, you know, years ago when we were using Exchange, everybody wanted to use Google Docs for everything. It was Google Docs was the best thing ever. And now that we're a Google Apps school, everybody's trying to find something else to use. And while I love Evernote, Google Docs in it, and for this situation, is really a better solution. It is real-time editing. I kind of explained to them, look, with Evernote, you're each working on a local copy, and then it syncs back up. With Google Docs, you're all working on the same copy. So it always is that kind of grass is always greener on the other side situation.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly the most compelling reason to use Google Docs in any situation is when you actually need genuine active collaboration at the same time. It's still tricky on iOS, unfortunately.
It's getting there.
It's getting there.
Yeah, yep. I think ultimately what we need in our world is we need either like a fully featured Google Docs, Google Drive app, or we need iTunes U to have a little bit more added to it, or we need a learning management system that'll be, we need kind of like a combination of about three applications to come together.
A shared space in iCloud would go a long way.
That's true. You know, that is very true.
You know, because iCloud has the mechanisms for it, and it has you know, conflict detection mechanisms and so on, but not conflict resolution. That's up to the developer. But you know, if a student's iCloud hosted documents just suddenly popped up in my iCloud user saying, you know, shared by this person under a little divider line, shared by that person, and so on, and then, you know, if my devices could participate in the sync along with their devices, then okay, you may, well, typically not in schools, I don't think. I was going to say you may end up with more conflicts, but I think typically in schools that the ownership of the document sort of goes in phases. The pupil owns it, it's submitted to the teacher notionally owns it for a while, and then the student takes control of the document again to do revisions or whatever. So that might be a way forward too. That's what, yeah, I would like.
Something almost like a student could mark this as, you know, kind of checked in or checked out, or teacher can mark it as, hey, I got mm-hmm. this document checked out and I can only access it right now. But we're close. Yeah. We're close. So how is it going with your iPad mini?
iPad mini? Very interesting. Very interesting. I've never been so conflicted. I said that last week and I'm still like that. But what I can tell you is that in the course of a week since we last spoke, the iPad mini has been almost the only iPad I've picked up for the whole period. And that really has surprised me because, I mean, I've got both of them right here. I've got the full-size iPad 3 and I've got an iPad mini, and the iPad mini is Wi-Fi only. It's 16 gigs, and the big one is 3G, and it's 64 gigs and the whole bit. But the iPad Mini is the one that I want to pick up. And that has surprised me. And the way I described it today to some folks was that it feels like the first MacBook Air that I ever had, which was a frustratingly compromised computer, right? In particular, it had sealed-in battery, not that much battery at the time either, very small 2.5-inch hard, not even 1.8-inch hard drive, as from the old iPods, fixed amounts of memory, minimal ports on it, lots and lots of technical compromises, but it was just such a compelling thing to own. The form factor was just so kind of perfect that you wanted to actually rearrange the way you worked with computers to make it possible to have a MacBook Air. And that's kind of the way I feel about the iPad Mini, is that it's much, much less compromised than the MacBook Air. The only real compromise you're making technically is the lack of Retina display. But you are then getting access to this fantastic form factor that is just such a delight to use in so many modes of operation. I found a couple of things that are tricky with it, and one in particular is I use an app called Penultimate, which is actually owned by Evernote. I use that as a kind of virtual whiteboard when I'm teaching, so I'll AirPlay the device to the screen, and I'll use a stylus to draw diagrams of whatever I'm teaching about. And I found it a little fiddly to draw an accurate diagram using a stylus on the iPad Mini. That may be a thing that comes with practice. I've noticed that my typing is already improving in speed just through practice. So maybe drawing with it will come in time as well. I was going to say one other thing about it, which has just slipped my mind. I'll come back to it if it comes back to me. But so far, I'm really, really enjoying it. And I am actually thinking about trying to get myself a cellular version when it comes out.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading Twitter today and saw one of my friends, Stephen Hackett of the 512 Pixels website, is going back to a dumb phone for a year and is just going to use his iPad Mini with LTE. He's mm-hmm. on the way as kind of his mobile computer. And it's an interesting concept because it is, you know, and you tweeted about it over the weekend. Imagine if you could have, you know, imagine if Apple did to voice calls what they did to text messaging with iMessage. If they had a phone-to-phone over their network phone call, you could theoretically have an iPad Mini as your phone.
Well, yeah, I thought it was really interesting that his post came up just after I had talked about that about a week ago. And I thought about this some more and did a bit more work on it. And I reckon that we're sort of 92% of the way there. That's not a scientific number. But looking at it, you know, you've got Skype on iOS, which is compatible with all the major features of Skype, including having a Skype in phone number so that people can make landline calls to a virtual landline that rings on your iPad Mini. I can make calls out using Skype credit. I can have my mobile phone's caller ID show up when I make that kind of call. I've got iMessage for text messages. Okay, that's only to iOS devices, but then it's a 98% world for me in terms of the people that I message who have iOS. And, you know, there are so many other ways on that device to contact me as well. I've got email, I've got Twitter DMs, I've got Facebook messages, all kinds of different ways, you know, other things as well. And at some level, okay, you're paying for the portability of the iPhone and the miniaturization, which is clearly superior to the iPad Mini. But in terms of services, you're paying a lot of money just to be able to receive a legacy SMS, you know? Mm-hmm. In many ways, that's what we're talking about here. The other issue is, of course, we should mention emergency calling, which is something that Skype doesn't really do anything to guarantee or help with. I've never tried to make an emergency call with Skype, so I don't know if it's sort of theoretically possible. But it is at least, for most practical purposes, you could probably get away with doing that kind of thing. And of course, you can hook up a Bluetooth headset or something to an iPad Mini as well and have it really behave very much like a phone in many respects.
Well, and to be honest with you, if you break my phone into three components, kind of web usage, which includes Twitter, reading, Instapaper, RSS, all that, then messaging, which I would say, you know, email and then iMessage and then phone calls. The phone calls is what I use ultimately the least. And in some ways, that's what you're paying for the most.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And there was some news recently about how much U.S. carriers are projected to lose because of data-based messaging services that are eating into the cost of SMS for users. So it looks like they're taking a wee chunk out of them as well. So it'll be interesting to see how it all comes along. So I'm not quite ready to order a cellular iPad mini right now, but I think it's just been interesting to watch myself do an organic shift from one iPad to the other. But I think it's quite interesting because today when we had that visit, I was sort of waving my iPad mini about and going, when you have your iPad, and you know, demonstrating my iPad mini. And I've stopped thinking about it like an iPad mini. I just started thinking about it like an iPad because the software compatibility is so perfect, so complete that it doesn't feel like it's in any sense a new device. It's just an iPad, smaller, in the same way that a 13-inch MacBook Pro is really no less a MacBook Pro than a 15-inch one or a 17-inch one, except for its physical size.
Well, it's been interesting, and I've jokingly said to a few friends that if someone offered me a straight-up trade of my third-generation Retina iPad for an iPad mini, I would take it in a heartbeat. I really would. I will probably wait another year before I move to it. From what I've seen, I do like it, but I will probably wait another year. Just, you know, assuming they release one next fall, I'll just get that one then.
Yep. I have no doubt that it's going to be a very, very popular device. I don't know that it will necessarily be the most popular iPad, but I think, you know, for somebody like myself, who I consider myself to be a serious power user of iOS, probably far more than most people are, and I'm the one who's picking up the iPad mini more and more often, I think it's got a bright future, definitely.
So what do we have for today?
Okay, we've got a couple of topics today. One, I wanted to bring everybody some news about a report that's just come out in Scotland, the results of a fairly broad one-to-one iPad research pilot that's been going on for the past sort of 6 months, I guess. And then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about the role of Microsoft Office in schools as Office for iOS is approaching, according to many of the rumor sites and the well-sourced news sites over the past week or so. We've seen some of the screenshots even surface for that, so we'll have a little chat about that as well. Let me just pull up my report here. I've highlighted a whole bunch of sections, but let me give you the background to it, which is that a number of local authorities in Scotland, local authorities are the local government organisations that basically own and operate schools in Scotland. It's quite an interesting model we have here because The Scottish government in Edinburgh doesn't actually directly run schools. That power is given over to local authorities and they own the buildings and employ the teachers and provide the resources and also run the schools. So they had asked some researchers from the University of Hull to come and investigate how various iPad deployments were going across Scotland, because in Scotland, like many countries, there's a lot of iPads have been purchased. And a lot of iPads are in use in schools, but they're not in use, generally speaking, as part of a deliberate and planned program of purchasing and use. They're being purchased on a very ad hoc basis. There are schools everywhere that have got one or two iPads, or maybe even up to a class set or something like that. And I think folks just wanted to kind of pull together what was going on and try and extract some of the best practice models that are being used in school. So what's available now, and there's a link in show notes to where you can get this report, is a sort of 100-page report by the folks at the University of Hull about what happened during the pilot, how the devices were used, what was the impact of the way the devices were used, how did parents react to it as well, what did teachers think of it, and what are their recommendations for the future of educational technology in schools in this country? So I've identified just a few parts of the report that I wanted to kind of highlight and possibly discuss as well. And the first one is they did some baseline surveys, which were surveys sort of as the pilot started, both of pupils and of parents, and looking at just how technology was currently used, and then trying to see what the impact was going to be of the pilot deployment. So one of the things that the report comes up with is they show the daily use of computers in lessons with a before and after, and it says that most students in the survey, almost 69%, now use technology in most lessons, compared to only 14% before the initiative started. It's also noticeable in this graph, which is page 50 for people who are looking at the report afterwards. It's noticeable in this graph how infrequently students use technology on a daily basis before the introduction of the iPad, with the largest single grouping, 44%, claiming to use it only occasionally. So what this chart shows is that it's broken down into how often did you use technology, and the options are every lesson, most lessons, some lessons, and occasionally. And if you look at the numbers for before, every lesson is about 5%, most lessons around about 15%, some lessons is just above 30%, and occasionally is 44%. So it's a kind of increasing graph in the proportion of pupils who use computers regularly as you go further away from being every lesson. So the vast majority of pupils reported some lessons or only occasionally for technology use. And for the after figures, what you see in this chart is that every lesson is up to about 9%. Most lessons is almost 69%. So between every lesson and most lessons, you're now approaching 80% of pupils in the pilot were using the technology, at least in most lessons, if not in fact every lesson. Some lessons is around about 21%, and occasionally is a tiny little bar that I can't even make a guess at how many percent it is, maybe 2% or so on. So that's a really, really interesting thing, because what it shows is that when you bring this technology in, you increase the number of devices, of course, but also bring it into the actual classroom where the learning happens, then the use of this device just skyrockets compared to what it was before. So I thought that was an interesting result. And it's noted by teachers in that section of the report that it's not that they sit the pupils down at an iPad and have them work straight for 2 hours, but it's frequent, sporadic use throughout the entire school day, rather than just a very intensive clump of use at some point during the day or during the week, which I think is very much akin to how you and I would use a device as well. And I think it's good to see people recognizing that technology use in school needs to look like the way that you and I use technology as well.
Well, excuse me, I've got some allergy issues, so if I cough, that is why. I kind of liken it to that my father-in-law loves to go on long rides. He has a BMW that's a convertible. He loves to go out on a Sunday afternoon and just drive. I have no interest in doing that. I actually don't like driving at all. I only drive to get myself somewhere. So I have a purpose with driving. And so it really, that's how we should look at technology in schools. We don't just do it because we enjoy it. We don't do a one-to-one deployment because we enjoy it. We don't do buy three iPad carts because the kids enjoy playing games or using them. They use technology because it gets them kind of where they're going. You know, if we want to teach them, how to do this math problem, and we can use it doing some technology that allows them to maybe learn faster or have better comprehension, that's why we do it. It's not for the fun of it. We have the ultimate end goal is learning.
Absolutely. But the beauty of it is that fun comes along for the ride, right? And it's interesting that you should mention fun right there, because what was found by the folks from Hull, they asked the pupils to report their own attitudes to the pilot after they had learned with the iPad for some time. And I'm just going to read you some of the statements they asked pupils to agree or disagree with. And I'm going to give you the statement, and then I'm going to give you the percentage that agreed or strongly agreed with that statement, okay? Number one, the use of the iPad in lessons makes learning more fun. 99.6% agree or strongly agree. I am more interested in learning when I can use the iPad in lessons. 96.2% agreed or strongly agreed. The use of the iPad helps me understand difficult ideas better, 93.9%. I prefer to use an iPad to a traditional computer or laptop, 93.9% again. I learned more when I used an iPad in lessons, 91%. I worked more with other people when I had the iPad, 88%. And I behaved better in lessons when I used the iPad, 87%. So these are numbers that are quite remarkable, in my opinion, even if they are self-reported numbers. We haven't really seen student numbers quite in that range up till now. It's quite marked, I think.
Well, it really goes, you want to get students away from feeling like it's a mundane process. Just as, you know, anything that we do, just as, you know, I put on music while I'm cleaning the house because it makes it more enjoyable. You know, I don't enjoy math, but if, you know, using, you know, iPad applications tailored to the lesson I'm learning makes it more fun, then that's great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought it was interesting. One of the things that is mentioned in the report is, it kind of approaches talking a little bit about whether the iPad is used as a fundamental part of the work or it's used as a reward after the work. And I think one of the things that I feel is quite a mistake to make is to confine the iPad to only being used as a reward for doing your traditional work correctly, just as a behavior motivator. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a situation where the use of technology can lead people to behave better because they want to show themselves responsible, they want to show themselves accountable and live up to people's increased expectations of them. I think that is a very powerful factor. And I believe that when you go one-to-one or similar situation, the trust that you have to place in people leads them to raise their game a little bit and behave better. But I think the benefits that you see from using the iPad as a gift at the end of a lesson will probably be quite short-lived, I feel.
Well, it's just, there's just no point. The technology, if we just wanted a reward, we could give them a board game or we could put on a television show.
Absolutely. I also, the next thing I wanted to highlight in the report was they asked the students what were the popular applications, what were the applications that you commonly used in your lessons or for your learning? Because it wasn't just in lessons. Many of the pilot schools also allowed pupils to take their iPads home. So they asked, this is in primary in the lower half of school, they found that the most popular applications that showed up frequently were Pages, Keynote, iMovie, Brushes, which is a painting program, Minecraft, actually, ArtRage, which is another painting program, Book Creator, which is a ebook assembly application on the iPad, which is great, an application called AB Math, and GarageBand. Interesting there that Numbers doesn't show up on that list, but Pages and Keynote do. In the secondary department, they found the most popular apps were in first place, Office HD, which I think possibly reflects that secondary teachers maybe have more documents in Word format, or schools maybe using Google Docs or something like that. So requirements to handle different formats in secondary may be more important than they are in primary. iOS Notes came in second, actually, in this list, which is interesting. iMovie, third. Various drawing apps is stated as four. Keynote, Calculator, My Brushes, Bejeweled Blitz actually shows up in that list. Sketchbook, EduCreation, OpenOffice HD, and then FaceTime actually shows up there as well, which I thought was quite interesting. So there's an interesting range, but what the report notes there is that all the popular applications are not content applications. People often think, well, I can deliver my content through an app and so on. But in fact, in all of these pilot schemes, schools, the most popular apps were apps where the user themselves had to invest something to make the app useful, a general purpose application of some kind.
Well, it's interesting that you kind of see a lot of the Apple apps, and I'm wondering if that's because people, you know that, know their quality, or if that's just, I guess, they're front and center from the beginning. You know, the Notes one is interesting, but anytime I'm at a conference, I do see a lot of people using the Notes application, but in reality, it's built in, it works fairly well, it syncs over iCloud. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a pretty good app if you're just taking some basic notes.
It's very, very dependable. So I've seen myself fall back to it sometimes if Evernote might be misbehaving a little bit for me, which it's sometimes known to do. I'll often fall back just to notes because it is very, very dependable.
Well, it's like using a, you know, if you've got a journal that you do a lot of note taking in, but you also have sticky notes, the notes application is the sticky notes.
Absolutely. Yep. There's a section called Other Reported Uses of iPad by Students, and research was the next most popular use reported by students. And this is starting to get to what I think is perhaps the heart of one-to-one deployments, really, is the fact that there's a very strong thread throughout the report of the transformational nature of having access to the internet at all times. And I often say to people, I said to my visitors today, look, if all the iPad had on it was Safari, we would still have deployed it because the internet's so important in education today. And particularly reasonably free access to the internet as well. You know, we've never argued for completely unfettered access to the internet, but I think far, far more open than most schools typically are is where it's at. So that was interesting. And there's talk in the report about various aspects of internet safety culture and so on that I think are powerful and useful. I wanted to also note there was, when we were talking about creative applications and various things, that one of the other things that's highlighted in the report is that the fact that pupils are able to undertake a lot of these creative processes on a single device, it says here, within a single device, overcoming many of the technical and logistical barriers that might otherwise make this a prohibitive undertaking in the classroom. Instead, the focus of such activities is essentially pedagogical, as students make movies and movie trailers to demonstrate their understanding of a process or explain a difficult or abstract idea. So this comes back to the notion that people sometimes used to say, you know, well, there's nothing new about making a movie on an iPad. I can make a movie on my desktop computer. And the answer, or not the answer, but the retort to which is, of course, yeah, but having it in your hand in the classroom at all times with everything integrated in one device and not having to plug in different devices and download, you know, an hour's worth of HD footage over FireWire and all this kind of stuff that we used to do to try and make a movie. It's not that you couldn't do it before, but it's that you didn't do it before because it's so much, like it says in the report, logistical effort. It's a really big deal. And finally, along the creative lines, there's a great quote from a student at one of the local schools. It's actually the one nearest to me. He says, or she says, I don't know, I don't feel confident enough to draw this kind of thing on paper, but on ArtRage, I'm fine because you can put a picture in the background as a guide, and if you make a mistake, you don't ruin the whole picture like you might on paper. And this is something that I've been thinking about quite a lot over recent weeks. I've done a couple of conferences recently, as we've mentioned, and I started to describe the way that we work with things like ArtRage and various other tools like that, creativity tools, as almost like simulators. You know, so if you're learning to fly a plane, you don't just step up to the cockpit of a 747 and go fly it. You practice on a digital simulator first, and then you take those skills and you transfer those skills over into the real situation. And I think that quote there is an example of that kind of thing happening, where pupils can practice in a safe manner, which has undo and so on, and then if you keep that work going, you can extend that across into more traditional art materials or traditional music recording or whatever after the fact. So that was interesting to see that quote in there as well.
It really shows that the iPad is a canvas.
Absolutely. Okay, next thing in the report was that there was a strong thread of just simple benefits that came through. And there's a section called Use of the iPad and Apps for Teaching, and it talks about various ways that teachers adopted the iPad. And that section I've highlighted here says, in some cases, these benefits are relatively simple but important efficiency changes, such as not having to photocopy multiple sheets or resources for each student, but some are more significant, such as the reliability of the device, in quote, a quote, it always works, which gave teachers more confidence to use it on a regular basis. And I think that reflects something that's been a bit of a theme of our show, is that you don't get that many chances with teachers. You know, episode 7 was called Teachers Don't Tinker. and they really don't tinker, you know. And what we saw in this report was that a device that is dependable and reliable. No device is perfect, but the iPad certainly showed itself in this pilot to be a pretty good device. And that led to an increased level of teacher engagement in the pilot as well, because the teachers knew that if they did something on this device, that it would then the next day do the same thing again for them, and it would work, and they would get the result they were looking for.
Yeah, we actually had our first iPad dropped yesterday. It did survive, but we did have our first one of the year dropped. And on hard floor as well, the students were terribly upset, but thankfully it survived, and it had a blue screen on it, which I kind of reminded me of the blue screen of death, but a simple hard reset, and it seems to be working fine. But I think that is so true, because when I think of you're trying to deploy new things to our teachers, you have to be very careful, because you kind of look at it as you're playing dollars and change with them, and you've only got so many dollars in your pockets to get them to try to do things. And if it's overly complicated, they're not going to do it. And they're just going to go back to their tried and true methods, because ultimately they're getting paid to teach, to not use technology. And if they see the technology as something that slows them down, or is something they're going to have to, you know, fiddle with, they just won't do it, regardless of how it'll impact mm-hmm. their instruction. And I can't mm-hmm. say that I blame them, because if I'm dealing with one of my vendors and he's got a great new product for me that'll really save me time, but I have to tinker with it, it's not worth it.
Yeah, unless you get a massive win off the other end, and there are not that many massive wins to be had. There's a lot of kind of house-to-house fighting in these kind of situations where you make very incremental gains. Every time you just change one thing, you get a little bit of a benefit and a little bit of a benefit and so on. Okay. There are some conclusions. Each section in the report has conclusions, and these are some of the conclusions that were drawn about the pedagogy that is used or was used in these pilot schools. And the first conclusion is this, that the availability in school of a personal tablet device like the iPad significantly increases the amount of time students can access technology to support their learning at the point it is required. And the phrase they're using in the report is just-in-time learning, where the pupil can pick up a device and interact with content or experiment with a creativity app just at the point where they want to learn an additional skill. They also found that even in schools where technology provision was deemed to be very good, students previously reported using it only occasionally, end quote. So what that shows is that our previous definitions of good technology provision are no longer adequate in a world where one-to-one is possible for some students. Data collected from students, parents, and teachers all highlighted significant transformations in the motivation, interest, persistence, and engagement of students following the introduction of the iPad initiative. It was evident that student dispositions towards learning had improved dramatically during the pilot, a fact that was recognized also by teachers and parents. We'll talk about parent attitudes a little more in a little while. So it has generally been shown to be a very, very positive benefit to every school that's deployed it, which I think is a big kind of told you so for me in particular, because what I think is quite gratifying is that this is one of the reports, and this is why I wanted to kind of highlight it, was that this is an academic report based on a broad study that shows a lot of the things that I have talked about for two and a half years are repeatable in other schools. And I had, in my naivety at the start of this whole thing, I thought, well, this is so easy. Everybody's going to do it, and they're all going to do it great. And it's, you know, there's no way this can go wrong. And then the last 2.5 years has been a process of me sort of becoming more and more aware that, in fact, there are unimaginably vast number of ways to do this wrong. And people have discovered and implemented quite a lot of them. So it's good to see that other places can do it right too. I mean, I always knew that was the case, but I wanted to see some people do it, I guess. Okay, next thing I wanted to talk about was the results of asking parents how they felt about technology, both in the classroom and at home. And one of the really, really interesting things about this was that parents, when the researchers asked the parents to rate themselves in terms of confidence using mobile technology, what they found was that people were asked to rate themselves as a confident user, an average user, below average, novice, or indeed expert, if that's available to them as well. And what we found was that 88% of people described themselves as at least average, and half, nearly half, 46%, described themselves as a confident or expert technology users. And this is another theme that I've been developing for in maybe a year's worth of talks now, is that today's parents are different people from the parents of 10 years ago that you were dealing with in school. Today's parents are, clear, as these numbers show, much more confident in the use of technology. They think of themselves as much more capable, and they are not afraid to report themselves as much more capable as well. Because in previous times, you might have had people who actually were decent on the computer, but they didn't have the confidence to say that they were good at it, and so on. And I think that we're getting close to half considering themselves either confident or expert, and the vast majority of people considering themselves average or above is a really, really interesting result. I think that's very, very significant for the future of both deployment policy and also just general use of technology in education.
Well, it's when you go to make a change or talk about a deployment, you can spend less time talking about, you know, I guess the non-technical things, and I'm trying to think of the word to say, like trying to explain how this is going to work. You know, you're thinking, how are they going to get email on a device? You can just say they'll have an email address. They'll be on Wi-Fi here. They're good to go. You don't have, the parents will get it. It's kind of like, you know, when my kid goes to school, he's still about a year or two away. I won't have to be explained about what a student information system is. I'll just know. I'll know that, okay, his grades are online. That makes sense to me. They should be. It's 2013. It's 2014.
That will be the time. Absolutely. Another interesting result out of parent attitudes to technology was to see how broadly unconcerned parents were about e-safety issues. This is really interesting to me. I don't have a very good explanation for it, but the study asked parents what their reasons would be for limiting access to the device at home, and only, I think it's only about 9% of parents that were surveyed said that online safety and privacy were their main reason for limiting their children's use of the device. The biggest one, in fact, was health issues. And really, by health issues, what we're really talking about is the decline of physical exercise and the decline of interest in sports and other kinds of activity in favor of technology. So that was certainly, I think, the top reason, which I think about 37% stated. And there were various other ones, including detracting from other social activities, detracting from actual academic work when the device is being used for games, and limiting family time, and so on. So interesting attitudes there. And I wouldn't say that parents were broadly or not completely uncritical. There's a noted minority of parents who had a reasonably negative attitude to the device, and in large part it was either around my child just plays games all the time, which is something that was new to some of those parents in the home, or the other one was, I think, I'll try to see if I can remember what the other one was. It was to do with, it was either excessive screen time, or I've lost the page. But anyway, there was a couple of reasons why that was the way it was. So very interesting numbers from parents. And the other thing that was asked of parents was how much do they use mobile devices with their children as they go through the week? And the numbers here say that 77% of parents help their children with homework using traditional media, compared with 14% doing so on a regular basis. This figure actually fell to 44% when technology was involved, with only 4% helping on a regular basis, which is interesting. The report says the discrepancy, which is significant, indicates parents are less confident or willing to support their children in school-related work when it involves technology, and invites the question of whether the introduction of a personal device such as the iPad into the home would compound the difficulty or help to alleviate it as parents become more familiar and confident with the device. There's also the possibility that children using the iPad maybe don't actually need their parents' help that much. That's my speculation. That's not in the report, but it's also a possibility. So the last number from parents was at the end of the survey, they asked, do you think your iPad Pilot has been valuable for your child? 83% said yes, 2.3% said no, and 13.8% said not sure. So those were the numbers by the end of the survey. Parents broadly on board with it, I would say.
Well, if it ultimately results in their kids being able to be in more direct communication with their teachers, staying on top of assignments, then there is no negative.
Yeah, and I think the other number that I wanted to mention that I forgot was that only before the study, only 10% of parents thought of a mobile device as a thing for learning with, whereas by the end of the pilot, it was the majority of parents that were now aware, it says here, that mobile devices have considerable potential to support their child's learning both inside and outside school. So the parent attitudes to the mobile device as a learning device significantly shifted over the course of the pilot as well. Other little stat, zero reports of equipment failure throughout the whole pilot, which I think is quite dramatic, actually. You know, there's a large number of devices involved in this. There's nearly 400 iPads, I believe, of various ages. Some are iPad 1, some are iPad 2. But there were no reports of equipment failure across the whole project, which is pretty great. I don't know if you've heard, there was a study of a reading charity sent Amazon Kindles out to Africa to help with reading programs. And in that project, they actually hit a 40% failure rate on the device. So I've heard this from other people informally on Twitter as well, where they've used cheap devices to do big schemes, but they found that a high failure rate is actually very detrimental to people's confidence in these programs as well. So failure rate is important. I think you and I have seen that as well, that failure rates on iOS devices are generally pretty low.
I have actually never seen one, I don't believe, that has actually failed from, you know, manufacturer's defect. Generally, it was dropped. That's accidental damage, and that's not Apple's fault. But I have yet to see. I guess I've seen one iPod Touch, it's a second generation iPod Touch, that the charging pins broke. Of course, now we have the Lightning connector, so that's no longer an issue.
Yeah. I've seen a few. Bear in mind, my iPads are some of the oldest iPads in the world right now. They were right off the boat as soon as they came into the UK. They were in our hands. So when we opened up, we found maybe two or three out of our 100 were not working out of the box. But that's not unsurprising for brand new hardware designs just being manufactured for the first time. And I think the story of all manufactured goods is that people get better at building them over time. So the chances of you getting bad devices out of the box today for full-size iPads is pretty low, I would say, and pretty good.
Well, and that's why there's always that kind of advice, you don't ever want to buy the first generation of a product when Apple makes a dramatic shift. I know we got the original unibody MacBook. My wife and I did after, I guess we had been married about a year, and we bought that. And I remember the trackpad broke within a couple of years. And I talked to multiple people that, you know, had that same thing. It was the first time they'd done that, you know, I guess single trackpad with the whole trackpad being the button.
Yeah, the sort of glass trackpad.
Yeah, it? And so thankfully I'm able to replace that myself, and it cost me $40. But again, that's a good rule of thumb. But yeah, I have you just hear less and less of my iPhone that quit working. It's usually I drop my iPhone and it quit working, or I drop my iPad and it quit working.
Yeah, drops are a fact of life with mobile devices, I guess. Okay. Last thing I wanted to mention, and this was this is where the rubber hits the road, right? Is a section called Resourcing During and Beyond the Duration of the Project, which is basically, what do we do now? It says here, and I quote, the key issue to recognize here is that all participants in these interviews could not envisage a situation where, firstly, the devices were taken back by the local authority or funding agency, and secondly, a future for schooling without the use of one-to-one handheld devices, end quote. And what that says to me is that the discussion is over. And it's time to get on with figuring out how to make this actually happen for people.
What?
So many issues we can talk about around that, and we probably don't have time for all of them, but go ahead.
Well, I said, I was talking to somebody today about they had a large collection of files, and I said, do you see yourself going forward having less paper or more paper? And they said, well, less paper. I said, then, okay, what are you going to do with the files you've got? You've got to digitize, though. You're not going to be able to go back. Your collection shouldn't grow, so let's digitize it. And it's really, it's like, do you 10 years from now in our schools see more technology or less technology?
That cuts through a lot of the rubbish that people talk, really and truly. If you ask people that question, you've basically done a checkmate move, you know. And of course there's going to be arguments about which device and how much and how do we deploy it and who pays for it and all that kind of stuff. But the question of whether we need to do this or not, I think, is really now beyond any serious argument against. The conversation's over as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. And we just want to keep our eye on, to the, future of, what devices, because there may be a day that the iPad isn't the best device. And
absolutely.
When that day comes, I will choose the best device, because that's mm-hmm. what I'm paid to do, is to make decisions. And if Apple stops, if Amazon comes out with something that is great for education, we'll heavily look at it. If Chromebooks, continue to, grow and then not increase in battery life as the new Acer one is. It's only 3.5 hours. But if they continue to get better, we'll look at those. If they work for education, they ultimately enhance the learning of our students.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, I've been the iPad guy up till now because iPad's been the only thing that is really seriously worthy of consideration in mobile computing. Now, nowadays, there are other things. I have considered them. I have decided that they are not as good as the iPad for what it is we want to do, so we're going to stick with iPad for now. But, for example, I look at the iPad Mini and I think, yeah, that's probably not the one I want to use either. So it's not that I just take the first thing that Apple comes out with or the latest thing that Apple comes out with and say, well, that's the thing that's got to happen for education. iPad Mini is working great for me, but I'm not really seriously considering it for the next generation of our one-to-one deployment. And the Kindle Fire and the Nexus 7, those are good devices if you want what it is they do for you. But what I think it's important to be very clear about what it is they do for you. And same with the iPad as well. What are these devices built for? What is their purpose? What is their orientation? And really make a very clear decision about that. And there will be things in the future. And it's also, it's important to note that you're talking here about possibly national deployments or very high level planning to go into big, big programs. It's not obvious to me that everybody has to do the same thing, right? It would be great fun to see Scotland go iPad, right? But I think there's, particularly in a country like Scotland, where we have 32 local authorities to cover the whole country, there's a very strong possibility that we could see some local authorities go for one device and other local authorities go for another device. So the only thing I've ever really advocated for is that people should make a choice and go for it and really, invest properly in a platform, whatever that platform is, and leverage that to the hilt. I think, to my mind, that's really what I'd like to see people do.
Well, it looks like we're about close to an hour in. Do you want to go ahead and table the office discussion for a future show?
No, let's keep going with that.
Okay.
Yeah, let's knock that one off. Yeah,
okay.
That's all I've got to say about the pilot program. It was an interesting one. Full disclosure, I should give, I was tangentially involved with this pilot program in that I and some of my colleagues were available to the teachers involved in the pilot for advice and support. In the end, we actually didn't do very much. We answered a few questions by email. We went and visited a couple of other schools. A couple of people came to visit us. We presented once to the whole group. But in the main, the teachers who were involved in the pilot actually came together in the schools and helped each other. And that was way, way more effective than having some sort of remote Yoda figure like me answering all their questions from afar. I think that was one of the other themes that came through the report was communities of practice, people working together and helping each other was really, really powerful. And with that, I'm done. People can read the rest of the report. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Before we move on to the next topic, do want to take a quick sponsor break. And we've got BDocs Timeline 3D for iOS back again this week. It is actually live in the App Store. It has been for a few days. And we've been talking about this for a few weeks. But then David Sparks over at MaxSparky.com, which he's a great person to follow on Twitter if you don't, had a nice write-up about it, how he had been in the beta test as well. So it's not just us talking about how fantastic it is. He kind of recommended it as well. And we are actually considering this application in our one-to-one next year for our fifth grade. We are looking and heavily planning towards moving one of our grades to one-to-one. And this will be one of the apps that we include. It's incredibly simple to use. At its core, it allows you to create standard two-dimensional charts, and then you can shift to a flyover effect that brings a visual focus to like individual events while showing them in relations to other events. It works great with AirPlay. You can present them using the display adapter or we're using Apple TV. And it's when I say it's the most simple way to create multimedia timelines, I really, really mean that. It's very, very simple to use. It makes you, it's one of those apps that takes something incredibly simple. When you show it to an audience, they think you're a programmer of some sorts. It's only $14.99 in the App Store. It's a universal app, so you get the iPad and the iPhone. It is in the volume purchase program, so if you're buying 20 or more copies, you do get it at half price. And again, in terms of iPad and iPhone software, it seems a little expensive. But I, thinking back to the Mac days when you're easily spending $50 per device for one piece of software. Again, it's a steal, especially if you're buying more than 20 copies. It's at bdocs.com. Search in the App Store for Timeline 3D. Again, I can't kind of go through how this, how easy this application is and how it's so beautiful on the output. The 2D and the 3D are so incredibly beautiful. They also have a Mac version at bdocs.com as well. The education license starts at $39, which is a big discount off the retail price of $65, and they also have site licenses as well. Again, the iOS app is hot off the presses. Search in the App Store for Timeline 3D. If you're in a history class right now, I encourage you to get this immediately. It is absolutely incredible. We thank them for sponsoring the show. I'll put a link to David Sparks' post about the app in the show notes as well. I encourage you to read that. Again, it's at bdocs.com. So again, okay. Looks like wanted to talk about Office for iPad a little bit. There was an article recently on The Verge about Office for iOS and Android revealed, and so we wanted to talk about that a little bit because really up until this point we've gone a good 2.5 years of iPad computing and there has been no Office. And if you listen to most everybody when the iPad came out, if you don't have Office, you can't get work done. One of the things I kind of wanted to run through quickly just for some historical context was look at how old is Office. And I did some research and I'll put a link to the article in the show notes on Wikipedia. The first version of Office for Mac came out in 1989. It came with Word 3, came out on August 1st. And then the first Windows version came out on November 19th, 1990. That included Word 1.1. Excel 2, and PowerPoint 2. I did not realize that PowerPoint was that old.
Yeah, it's certainly got quite a history to it. I like to remind my pupils that the people who started writing Microsoft Office could be dead by now because kids don't really appreciate just what a kind of history these products have got. And I don't know if anybody who wrote Word actually is dead or not, so don't please be upset if you know those people, because I'm not announcing their deaths on the podcast. But just I use it as a phrase to explain to people how eventually, as you write software, the people who started this will no longer be around. If you're the guy that starts it, you will eventually want away from this project. And you use that phrase to kind of emphasize the importance of maintainability in software.
So one of the things I think it's important to look at is what is Office at its core? And you've kind of got, you know, well, not counting Microsoft Access, but if we look at the three core, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, what are they at the core? You know, we often say, well, you've got to have Office to do this. You've got to have Office in business. And so, but what, you know, look at what are you doing? Because it, you know, I go to a conference, I see people taking notes inside of Word. And I think, is that the best application for simply taking text notes? And I think it's important to know that Word at its heart is a word processor. Excel at its heart is for spreadsheets. And then PowerPoint at its heart is for making presentations. And so if you're not in a situation where you need word processing, do you need Word? If you're not making presentations, do you need PowerPoint? And then if you're not, you know, working in Excel, do you really need, or I'm sorry, if you're not working with spreadsheets, do you really need Excel? Because it's, you know, with all the growth of a lot of services, Google Docs, Evernote, and then obviously the whole app ecosystem and iOS, it's really come down to, do we really need Office at this point? Is that something that's required to, quote unquote, get work done?
True story. A previous job I worked at, I had to submit my quarterly reports in PowerPoint format. I'm not making this up. And quite often, I think some of the reasons why these apps are used in situations where they're not necessarily appropriate is because if you work across institutions or some such, then these are like the only three file formats that you can guarantee that everybody can work with. You know, not even PDF is as ubiquitous as these formats. So yeah, I've seen Word used in lots of pathological ways, including a school I spoke at one time. They sent me a letter of thanks from the head teacher, which was very nice of them, but they sent the letter as a Word document in an attachment to email and things like that. So a bit of a slightly old-fashioned workflow poking through there.
So, excuse me, you know, thinking about, you know, moving back to the Mac days and the traditional desktop, the deployment model for Office, I don't know about over in your neck of the woods, but over here, it's kind of very simple to get Office, especially for the Mac. You work with a local reseller. You can buy, you know, multiple licenses at a time. We pay about $52 for the student edition of Office, which is drastically cheaper than the, you know, the kind of the quote unquote business edition. But and you would log into Microsoft's Volume Licensing Center, and you can download, basically download the disk image. Now, up until this point, the Mac version that's volume licensed does not require you to enter in a serial number on installation. I believe it's kind of hard-coded into your download, so it's a unique download, where the Windows version now, best I can tell, requires a serial number. I guess they've had so much piracy of Office for Windows, they've had to do that for the volume licensing. And so you look at, you kind of say, okay, well, that's pretty easy. You can, you know, get it and you can install it on multiple computers. It's a pretty easy deployment model. And so then you move to the iOS world where everything's easy. It's as simple as, you know, click a button, install, you're good to go. And so how does Office differentiate itself? What does it do differently? How is, you know, what's its role, I guess, is my question at this point. What do you ultimately need it for? You've been running an iPad school for, you know, close to 3 years now without Office.
Yeah, and a Mac school without Office for many years before that as well. We standardized on iWork. I can't even remember when it was, but I think it was probably 2005, 6, around that time, possibly. Word's big draw, Office's big draw, is the tens of hundreds of billions of documents that exist in their native formats. And on top of that, the second thing that Word exists to serve is many, many automated workflows that are built on top of Office. So, for example, when I remortgaged my house a year ago, what I did was I basically went into an office in the bank and I watched somebody operate Word on my behalf, which is kind of bizarre, but also true. Because what they had there was our bank had a system whereby you would fill in a form with, you know, how much money I earn and all that kind of stuff, and my vast podcasting income and so on. And then VBA would kind of lumber into action very slowly, and it would slowly, slowly, slowly build this Word document that they would then print out, and I would sign my life away on it. And And that was how we apply for a mortgage, you know. So there are many, many workflows that are built on top of Office as well for many large commercial organizations. So there's that kind of stuff. But of course, none of that is happening on iOS, right? You know, the people want to bring their documents with them, but none of that VBA workflow stuff is happening on iOS. So it's a slightly more vulnerable version of Office that shows up in these mobile devices.
Well, and one of the things that is kind of really, you know, I guess I'll kind of go out on a limb and make a prediction that I don't think this will matter at all for schools. Now, it will probably largely succeed in the workplace. And if you go to in a year from now, you'll probably go into a Fortune 500 company and all of their iPads will have Office on them just because that's the de facto standard, as we've said. But the thing that really concerns me, again, this is just the rumor. Let me find the quote. The apps will allow for basic editing, but we're told this won't go very far in attempting to replace regular use of a full desktop Office version.
In which is revealed the entire problem is that Office for iOS will probably just not be very good.
Where I actually prefer, you know, I've not used Numbers or Pages a ton, but I've used Keynote quite a bit on the iPad, and I prefer it at this point over the desktop version.
Yeah, I've seen, I've used Microsoft 365 through Safari on the iPad, and it does a good job of trying to be like a bit like a Surface tablet through HTML5, but it's still clearly HTML5, and it's also using a lot of Microsoft gesture conventions from Windows 8, which are not native to iOS either. So I guess my big concern with Office for iOS, which is my same complaint as goes against Google Drive for iOS, is that they're not actually native applications, right? They're essentially web applications wrapped up in an iOS-like shell. And that veneer of nativeness breaks down very, very quickly. Now, like you said, we've only seen screenshots of the Office for iOS so far, but my strong suspicion is that they're going to leverage a lot of the work they've done for doing these kind of things through HTML5 and then make it look as much like an app as they can. I would be delighted to be proved wrong on that. I would love for Office to be, you know, one of the greatest iOS applications that's ever been built, but I have to say right now I do not have a great degree of confidence that that is either possible or indeed likely to happen.
Yeah, I really think that Microsoft has already made one mistake, and they're about to make another one if these rumors are correct. Number one, their biggest mistake was not releasing it 6 months after the iPad was introduced. Because what has happened is it showed people they can get work done without Office. And I would venture to say if you go to a college campus today, you'll see a lot of laptops without Office on them. I know my sister-in-law is at the University of Georgia, and she got Office when she bought her Mac, and the first thing they had her do was install OpenOffice.
The university had her do that?
The university recommended OpenOffice or NeoOffice, which is another component, which is another kind of fork of OpenOffice. And that's what they use because they can guarantee that everybody's got that. It's free. That's what they wanted to use. And so it's kind of like a whole generation of kids have grown up on Google Docs and Google Docs type services and just don't really care much about using Word. With our generation, we grew up in, you got business done with Word. And that's what you used. And it goes back to, again, turning in reports on PowerPoint, which, you know, will boggle your mind. So I think that was their biggest mistake, is if they would have had it out very soon after its launch, people would have installed it just as, you know, they could have sold it for, you know, sell Word for $15, sell Excel for $15, sell PowerPoint for $15. They would have sold a ton of them. People, you know, you would have every business that had been buying them. Every school would have been buying it on every iPad they bought, most likely. So that was their first mistake. I think the second mistake is kind of, again, as you said, releasing a watered-down version. Because we've ultimately, as we mentioned in the follow-up, we've got kind of a workflow issue here with iOS. There's some things that we would love to improve upon. And while Apple has the native app down, they don't have the sharing down. Where Google's got the sharing down, they don't have the native app down. And then this could be an opportunity for Microsoft to come in, you know, along with bolstering their Office 365 platform, which they do have an education component, say, look, you know, switch to us for email, you get access to SkyDrive, you can do markups, you can do all this stuff natively in the application, the sharing works, the collaboration works. That's very attractive to a school. And I'll be honest with you, if they had that out today, I would heavily consider that kind of workflow for our school.
I agree. I think if I was the Google Docs project manager, I would be mildly concerned. I think it's going to be an interesting arms race to see whether Apple gets sharing right before Google gets native apps right, before Microsoft gets both of those things right. And I don't think I could place a bet on who's going to get it right first. Google is certainly making some progress towards that, and in typical Google fashion, we see them release version after version of the Google Drive application that gets a wee bit closer and a wee bit closer and a wee bit closer to what it is we all want it to be. And don't get me wrong, I do want it to be very good because I would love to use it. I don't know where Microsoft's commitment to this whole thing lives at all. And we'll have to see what they ship it, how much they charge for it, and how it performs to see, and also how quickly it gets better to see where their commitment lies. Clearly, on the Apple side of the house, the apps are fantastic. iCloud is a major step forward, but iCloud, as currently constituted, doesn't even do a terrible job of sharing. It does essentially no job of sharing. It doesn't even begin to address that problem. So I think it will be a fascinating year and a half, 2 years in that whole space. And, you know, there's possibilities that people like Evernote might come in and pick up some of that traffic as well, because in many ways, if what you want to do is quite simple, like the simple Word document type thing, or just even, I guess, knowledge management, then Evernote might actually be a good option as well.
Well, because I think Word ultimately becomes overkill for a lot of people, because it seems to me Word was built for an environment where you were typing reports and you were printing them out and handing them in. You had the footers, you had the headers. And does that matter as much in an all digital world?
There's a big element of that. I think that word processing as a practice, or I mean, some people in publishing are kind of push back on when I say this, that word processing is actually not the same thing as laying things out on paper to print. But in most people's common practice, and certainly in schools, a lot of the stuff that you do in a word processor is around formatting the document in such a way that there's going to be a final result that typically lies on paper. And is then doing whatever you do with paper. And I think we're certainly into a world now where a lot of writing is done in places that are not on paper. You know, there's people write for Facebook, write on blogs, write on social networks of all kinds, write in email. There's a lot of writing and communication goes on that doesn't have to be laid out for paper. And I think one of the decisions that we made quite a few years ago was that we were going to de-emphasize the role, the sort of fetishistic role of the word processor in the school. And for us, it really has reduced to a place to type stuff and then share a file with somebody. We're not doing a lot of work in formatting and so on, because so often now when you write, there's a content management system or something that handles the formatting for you, and then your words make it through to the end product. Presentation software is a different thing. I still believe that presentation skills, and part of that is the good use of presentation software, is a very, very valuable skill. In fact, it's probably never been more valuable, because if you think about it, word processing is a kind of secretarial level skill, and persuasion and communication is a CEO level skill. And I think the relative importance of those two parts of the Office suite, and indeed the iWork suite as well, has really dramatically shifted in the past 3 or 4 years.
Well, and I often wonder, should we be teaching kids about Markdown versus word processing? You know, teaching them how to write for the web. I'll think back to my days in school, and doing good research is a good skill. Mm-hmm. Putting together good presentations is a good skill. Knowing how to do, you know, a header and footer, and then do, you know, MLA citations. Like, I guess I struggle with the usefulness of that once the kid gets out of school.
Yeah, I think in many ways you want to, or I want to, maybe not everybody does, but I want to avoid doing a lot of work just as infrastructure for doing more schoolwork, you know, like you said. Now, yes, formatting an academic paper is an important part of the whole process, but I think it, even academic publishing is changing as well. And you know, we may see a future time where those documents are much more flexible and malleable than they've ever been before as well.
Well, it seems like a lot of those documents could be done as blogs as well. And of course, the frustrating part for us being a K-5, okay, let's say we get on that mindset and we're going to de-emphasize word processing and things like that. Well, as soon as they go to middle school, we're going to get told, well, the kids didn't learn word processing at your school because, you know, they're reporting back to us how our kids are doing. And so that's It's a very frustrating scenario since we don't go all the way through the 12th grade.
That's one of the privileges of where I work is that we have a straight through situation. And in many ways, it's at least when pupils leave my school, it's not really entirely my problem what happens at their next school. And I know that a lot of pupils who have left our school for other schools, their parents have actually bought them iPads to use for school once they get to other places. But I talked about this at a conference a couple of weeks ago in Hull, and a guy came up to me afterwards. He was the chief executive of the local telecom company. He said, look, I want to put something in your mind when you talk about this. You need to get yourself in front of some business leaders and tell them the story you've just told me today, because he is saying, as a business person, I'm concerned that the people that I'm trying to recruit for my business will be actually much further ahead than the state of the business. And he said, in one sense, I'm keen on that because it brings fresh ideas into the business. But on the other hand, I think it would be a great challenge in recruitment and to bring these kind of kids through into the workplace without some dramatic changes in the workplace as well. And I said to him, look, there are definitely studies that show that the new generation of workers look on things like bring your own device and personal access to social networks and email. They don't consider that to be something that is a privilege or a perk of the job. They consider that to be a fundamental way that business should work today. So those big changes are pushing through the whole system as a result of what we're doing here.
Yeah, it goes back to it's no longer a can I get access to my data offsite? It's I need access to my data offsite. I need access to my email wherever I am. I don't want to have to be on the network to get that. I want to access the information allows me to get my work done wherever I am, and you figure out how to do that in a secure manner.
Yeah, and like we said in past shows, in some ways, enabling that is our payback for people working at times where they typically shouldn't be working. You know, cutting into a bit of family life or something, or evenings or a bit of weekend work. In many ways, I think that's the least we can do for our teachers and indeed our students.
I definitely agree. So I think it'll be interesting to see, the pricing. I've heard rumors of for non-educational customers, like of $6 a month for, I guess, your subscription to Office 365. I think if you have an active subscription, that you kind of get it built in. And again, they've got an education component that's free. So I think this is they've got an opportunity here. Somebody, you know, between Apple, Google, and Microsoft, as you said, somebody's got an opportunity. You know, with Apple, they had the iWork.com suite and for sharing, and that seems to have disappeared after the retirement of that. And so maybe they're working on something. We need somebody to take the lead here and kind of nail, these kind of workflow issues of turning in stuff and then, grading it and getting it back.
Yeah, I'm not personally confident that Microsoft will nail the user experience around this, but I do think that Microsoft will nail the tools around this. Because if there's one thing Microsoft has always been really good at, it's looking after their customer. And who is Microsoft's customer in most school and corporate situations? It's not the person who's using the software. Microsoft's customer, broadly speaking, is the IT department. And like you said, with the ease of installation, when you get a customized download of Office that includes your serial number built into it, it could not be easier to blast that out over one of your configuration management tools for Mac desktops or Casper Suite or whatever it is you use. Microsoft have always done a pretty good job, I think, of taking care of their customer. And they are also crystal clear about who their customer is, and it's not the guy who sits down in front of the computer and uses their software.
It'll be interesting, very interesting. Any more thoughts on Office?
I'm roughly still awake by the end of a conversation about Microsoft Office, so I think that should be counted as a win. I have been Microsoft Office free for quite possibly more than 10 years now. And I think one of the things about it is that, you know, we've got workable import and export of Word and PowerPoint formats into iWork, and there's nowhere else I would rather work if I have to use those kind of tools. And Keynote's the one I use the most by far, but also Numbers to a certain extent, which I like too, and Pages when I have to, but I've just found that my use of a word processor is nothing like what it was before. So we'll see how it goes, but I think the higher level conversation, the sort of out of school conversation is it true that an Office suite, whether Apple's or Microsoft's, that is not the same thing as computer-based creativity, right? For too many people, the definition of creativity in education is typing an essay in Microsoft Word on a Windows PC, and I think that world has gone. And really, it's a consequence of that world having disappeared that we will then see the consequence in terms of Office sales and take-up of Office and so on, rather than just the fact that Office is not particularly good on iOS.
We've moved on from the we have to have Office world, and kids are saying we can use Evernote, or I can just use the notes application to type my school notes. I don't need Word. This has got to be concerning for Microsoft. That, and again, it goes back to what I said about their biggest mistake is they were not on the fastest growing platform in terms of, you know, I guess tablets, which is a growing platform, for 2.5 years.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, they're not on the two fastest growing platforms, right? Because they're not on Android either, right? So you add together the shipments on iOS, both tablet and phone, and Android, majority phone, but a section of tablet too, and then Kindle Fire. You put all that together, and that's a massive bulk of people's computing experience that people are now rapidly investing in, and Microsoft is nowhere on any of it. And that is a massive problem. You know, by some estimates, I read a measurement recently that said if you consider smartphones and tablets to be PCs, the same as PCs, then Microsoft's share is down to about 30% of all of that. Yeah, and that is something to be concerned about.
You know, they call themselves a software company. And if you consider it'd be like if Evernote said, we're going to only release Evernote for the Mac. Well, but you kind of want to be everything to everybody and store everything anywhere. So you need to have something on everything. And if Microsoft makes a big chunk of its money on Office software sales, why are you not on every single platform?
I suspect there's probably some tension in Microsoft as well over whether the full touch-based Office suite is something that remains an exclusive advantage for the Surface or the Windows RT platform or the Windows 8 platform as a whole, or do they go for total ubiquity or try and restore the total ubiquity of Office across all platforms? And I think they've kind of taken their eye off that ball very definitely. And I guess, you know, with the executive changes at Microsoft that have happened, Steven Sinofsky's now left. Will there be a change of emphasis in Microsoft as well to say, well, okay, maybe Surface doesn't have the massive center of gravity they used to have. What else is going to happen now? Perhaps Office becomes a thing that all the weight goes behind and Surface is left to stand or fall on its own merits rather than being a device that is the one true touch-based Microsoft Office platform. Time is going to tell.
It'll be a fun school year, and it'll be a fun summer because, you know, conceivably if it comes out in a few weeks and you have some new deployments for schools next summer, it'll be interesting to see how many of those include Office.
Yeah. Especially when it's subscription-based as well.
Yeah, that's true. It's not even – so if you're a Google App school, what do you do?
Yeah.
So it's not even – you know, it would ideally – you know, it'd be nice if all these companies just – maybe we had a document management API, then you could use iWork or you could use Google or you could use Microsoft, and they all work together. But I guess that's probably
– And I'd like a pony as well, but yes.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting. I think it's just – yeah, I don't know. I think we're a better world to not be dominated by Microsoft Office.
I agree. Word does a good job. PowerPoint doesn't do a very good job, and Excel. A lot of people love Excel, so yeah. Let's keep our eye on that one. come back to it maybe once it's released and see what we think.
Well, I guess that's the show. Where it looks like we're getting close to an hour and a half in. So, again, thanks to BDoc's Timeline 3D for sponsoring the show this week. Again, if you've not, just go to the website, take a look at it. The guys we've been working with over there have been great. It's just a great app. I want to go back and do a history project just to use this application. It's dead simple to import media. It's just, you know, we often say that it's harder to do things in a simple way, and they've done that. They really put a lot of work into the iPad and the iPhone version. They've just done a great job. $14.99 in the App Store, but again, if you're going through the volume purchase store and you're buying 20 or more, you get that at half price. Again, it's an absolute steal. It's bdocs.com for their website, or just search for Timeline 3D in the App Store.
Awesome.
I guess we have a special guest next week, is the plan.
Yep. We're going to do the Evernote show.
Of course, it'll be Thanksgiving week over here in the States. So if you're traveling, I guess we may end up releasing that show a day or so early, just so you can possibly download it before you go and travel. My wife and I will be driving a couple hours away to visit some family, which is always fun with a 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a good show. You can find me on Twitter and app.net at Bradley Chambers, and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, website spears.org.
We'll have all the links we talked about today in the show notes, and a link to the PDF as well. Looks like it's about 13 megabytes, so I'll upload that somewhere, and we'll throw a link to it. It's pretty good to add to your iPad PDF reader of choice, and just browse that over the holidays. So we'll be back next week.